For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford in the Catholic Cave. With me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. Gentlemen, to say the world is in a state of tension right now is an understatement, to say the least. How do we make sense of it? Where do we go and who do we look to guide us through the tension, the anxiety, and, you know, the challenges that we face? You know, first of all, we're in lockdown. Second of all, we've got everything going on out there in the world. Where do we make sense of it and how do we come to grips with it?
Yeah, I'm reminded of that old ancient Chinese proverb or ancient Chinese curse, really. May you live in interesting times.
And, I
think we live in interesting times, to say the least. There's no doubt about it. But, you know, that's kind of what we're here for at the Cave. You know, we kind of look around what's going on in the world and we try to dig a little bit deeper, try to get underneath the surface and look at kind of some of the philosophical issues that are underlying a lot of what we're reading in the headlines. So right now we've got, we've got protests in the streets. We've got, We've got a kind of unrest that's coming out of us being kind of in lockdown mode because of the pandemic. There's all sorts of political tension and things in the air. So, and when I'm looking at all of this, to me, Tim, the Catholic thinker that in some ways I go back to really make the most sense of it is one of the more recent Catholic thinkers, the late René Girard.
Yeah, I think Girard will be very helpful in terms of his philosophical theories and his writings to, again, help us maybe make sense, and understand a little bit about what's going on. There's no silver bullet here. There's no one person that's going to unpack it all for us. But I do think he offers some very valuable insights. As kind of an explanatory conceptual framework to begin to make sense a little bit about what might be going on, to your point, you know, more at the bottom of things, or at least closer to the bottom of things, not at a surface level, but at least below the surface, what might be happening.
Right, because, you know, the very surfacey answer, you know, when somebody asks, you know, what the heck is going on? Why is the world seeming to be falling apart at the seams? The most logical answer and the quickest answer is, well, it's sin. Man is by nature sinful. You know, human nature is endowed with sin because of the fall. And all of this is kind of a result of that. Well, you know, that's a very surfacey understanding. And Girard, I think, really, above all other theologians or philosophers in the Catholic tradition, really gets at what human sin, what that fallen nature, what that fallen state of humankind really is, where it comes from, what it's rooted in, what its nature is, where it's going, where it's headed, what it really means for us to be sinful creatures. And I think that's why Girard, at least in times like this, is so very valuable.
Yeah, so let's start with maybe a little I'll share maybe a little biographical information about René Girard. As you might be able to tell by his name, he's French.
Yes, he's French, but he's also, I will adopt him as a native Hoosier.
I will too, yeah. You're previewing where we're going to go with his little sketch of his background. So born on Christmas Day, 1923, and he passed away pretty recently, especially when you studied philosophy, very recently, November 4th, 2015, born in Avignon, France, immigrated to the United States in 1947. So that was quite a while ago, but he was still by most standards, a young man. He had earned a PhD in history from where? IU.
Right.
And, if you're listening outside of the great state of Indiana, IU always means Indiana University. It never means anything else than that. So that's why he's a native. That's why we adopt him as a Hoosier here in the great state of Indiana.
There's a show we have to do sometime is What's a Hoosier?
Oh, that is.
We could easily spend a whole hour on trying to unpack that one. I mean,
correct. Yeah. And Indiana speak too.
Right.
Because I'm a transplant as well. And I've picked up some of the Indiana twang. It was very twangy when I first moved here. I was like, what? So, because I was from a little further north.
I see. I'm originally from a little further south. So, you know, I kind of hear the Hoosier accent. I definitely hear a Hoosier accent.
Yeah.
It's a little different to my ears, too.
So, yeah, that
sounds perfectly normal to me.
Right. Exactly. Well, that's right. If you're here, born, it sounds exactly the way it should.
Born, raised, and baptized.
All right. So after he came to the United States he had earned his PhD in history, he began teaching, and he taught at a variety of different schools, including IU, John Hopkins, and Stanford were a couple of other places he taught. But Mark, you know a little interesting fact about what he taught, or at least how he started his academic career.
Right. Yeah. You know, and he spent most of his career at Stanford, and I think that's the institution he's most associated with, is Stanford. And as you said, he got his degree in history, but at the time that he was looking for faculty positions, there really wasn't a history position available. So they threw him to the lions and asked him to start teaching world literature. So I've listened to some interviews of him as he kind of goes through this of his biography of I was thrown in teaching literature and I really knew nothing about world literature. So I started just kind of scraping around, trying to figure out how to, dissect literature. And honestly, I think that was a little bit of a providential type of assignment for him, because it was really as he was unpacking literature and looking for what makes the great classic literature, whether it's Shakespeare, whether it's Dostoevsky, whether it's the greats of French literature, what do they have in common? What's their common tie? And that's really where he started to generate his theory of this idea of sort of as he put it, mimetic desire, which is sort of a desire that's based on sort of a 3 points. So if I want something, Tim, and you want something, and let's say we want the same thing, it's not that we really want that object. What's at the base of it is that we want to become or be somebody that we're not. And so our desires are all rooted in this desire to become somebody else. It's based off of a model. So hence the idea of mimesis, mimetic. So and this is an idea that comes from Aristotle. You know, Aristotle kind of said, above all else, man is kind of a mimetic being. We like to imitate. We're an imitative being. And so Girard kind of took this idea that we want to imitate somebody else. And he saw this as sort of a common thread of all the great themes in literature. There was this thread of attention that's created by two characters that desire one way or the other to become a third character. And sometimes it was just two characters. So sometimes it was just the one character wanting to be like the other character and that creating the tension. But it's a beautiful insight into human nature that at the root, we really, all of us, desire to become somebody who we're not. At the root of all of us, we are dissatisfied with ourselves. And in some of his later works and in some of his more religious works, you know, Girard kind of ties this back to the fall, that when we fell and we lost that idea of us being created in the image and nature of God, that what we did is we supplanted our own nature as being in the image of God. We supplanted that with this envy that was whispered to us by the serpent in the garden, so that we would be like God. And so that envy becomes sort of the very first sin. It becomes the root evil, is envy and desire, and that desire to become somebody whom we're not. And as Christians, you know, we very quickly recognize that desire to become somebody whom we're not is really that innate desire to make ourselves like God, which is what Satan whispered in the garden.
Yeah, I want to pick back up on and unpack it just a little bit here before we come up on our first break, which is this idea of desire for René Girard. So, you know, I think what he points to is that desire really is essentially, it's borrowed, right? We desire something because someone else desires it, like you were saying, but therefore it's also changeable. And it's also based on people who are typically close to us. And by close to us, it may be by relationship or it could be by other affiliations. And so a couple of quick examples that I can think of is it's very, you know, kids at a certain young age, you know, say, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, there's a point at which they want to, the daughters want to be like mommy and the boys begin to want to be like daddy. And so little girls will play dress up. They'll go into mom's closet and pull her stuff out and dress up like mom to be like her because they see mom, what mom likes as now becomes they like it too. You see that all the time. Another example, getting back to this, you know, kind of share where our desires come from, how it emerges is that, I think, Girard calls it, there's a kind of triangulation that you were talking about, Mark, where you have, you know, person A, person B, and then you actually have an object. And the object could be, it could be a thing. It could be another person. You see it in, sometimes in romantic desires. You see it portrayed in film quite often where, say, two men desire the same woman. And then these desires, because of that triangulation, the two people pursuing or desiring the same object, objects are finite. In other words, there's the limit to them. And so therefore, there can arise what a kind of scarcity to it. There's a limited quantity of any one thing. And therefore, the desire emerges into or transform into what? Rivalries. Rivalries. And I know we're up on time, so I think we're going to take a quick break and maybe we'll pick it up there.
Yep, we'll pick up with more on René Girard and how he's going to talk us through the anxieties we're feeling these days. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Alexa, what's the weather forecast for today?
Alexa, what time is the Colts game today?
Alexa, remind me to pick up the dry cleaning tomorrow.
Has Alexa become a part of your daily routine? Then make sure that routine includes Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Quick, easy access to Catholic programming 24/7. Just say, Alexa, play Catholic Radio Indy.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford. And we are trying to get under the surface a little bit of some of what we're seeing in the headlines. So we are seeing protests in the street. We are seeing unrest. We are seeing tensions. And so we're talking a little bit about the theories of the Catholic philosopher, social critic, theologian. He was really a jack of all trades, René Girard. And as we were laying out sort of the basis of Girard's theories, which is based around this idea of mimetic desire, so desire that's based off of imitation. We want to imitate somebody, and so therefore we want the things that they have. And, you know, this leads into tensions. And, you know, since this is the root of Girard's theory, it leads to a very, I would say, a very durable set of ideas that has applications in all sorts of different theory, all different fields. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about Girard is his ideas have impacted economics, as you were talking about. You know, there's a scarcity of goods out there, and economics is really the study of the distribution of scarce goods. You know, advertising and marketing, Girard's ideas are eminently applicable to advertising. They're also very much applicable, and we'll get to this down the road here, to religion and to theology. And of course, they're also, I think that they've got a political component to them, which is kind of the main thing that we're talking about here. So his theories are very durable, and they're based off of this idea that we as human beings are just by nature unsettled. We desire to be somebody else. We desire to become somebody else. And what we want to become, we base it off of models that we see out there. And as you said, Tim, what happens is tension and rivalry gets created depending on how close we are to these other people that we're kind of competing with for either scarce goods or competing with for the same image. There's nothing that creates more rivalry than somebody whom you admire that you're close to. So if you think about growing up with your best friend, and your best friend is a good quarterback, and you want to be a good quarterback, that automatically is going to create rivalry between the two of you. It's going to create competition. And so that competition starts to build. And since we live in society as human beings, Girard points out that we're not talking about just one competition, and we're not talking about just one rivalry. We're talking about a series of rivalries and sort of a network of rivalries that spreads throughout our own social network. So it spreads throughout our families. It spreads throughout our neighborhoods. In schools, you see these rivalries and conflicts just sort of run rampant.
Yeah, Gerard talks about how these rivalries intensify, again, as persons draw closer. And you're right, it's not just objects. It can be around goals, our affections, our interests. Let me share with you, I'm going to date myself a little. I want to share a little bit about some examples where this is really kind of, it might draw this out a little bit. So advertising relies heavily on this mimetic theory that René Girard articulates. Not that they are drawing from his work, but they advertising taps into it. So you may remember, you're a little younger than me, but you may remember, and some listener may remember, some of these fads that have come up, usually leading into Christmas, around different toys that become extremely popular. And then there's just a huge rush to get them and drives the price up. So a couple of examples that I remember that got a lot of notoriety at the time were Cabbage Patch Kids. So all of a sudden, you know, someone invented Cabbage Patch. Now, I raised two boys, so I didn't experience this firsthand. But, you know, Cabbage Patch Kids are these relatively, you know, they're kind of cute little dolls. But all of a sudden, every kid had to have one. Mostly, you know, every little girl had to have one, and they had to have one for Christmas. And so the price of these things, one, they became very rare in stores because everyone was scooping them up. Then, like on eBay, they're being put up for sale on eBay, and they were going for prices that were far, far, far higher than what their actual, say, ordinarily their commercial value would be. And it's all because, you know, little Susie has a Cabbage Patch. Well, her friend Jane, she's got to have one. And being a good parent, what are we going to do? We're going to go get one, you know, and whatever it takes. And it's happened with my kids. It was Pokemon cards. This is going back to the late 90s. There's been Beanie Babies. And I don't know, Mark, you've got five girls. Have you run across this before with toys?
Oh yeah. 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 The rivalries, we went through the Trolls phase.
Oh yeah.
Yep. And the one that was the most, to me, nonsensical was the Shopkins. Every little kid had to have their set of Shopkins, which are like these just like little tiny figurines of household products. They're kind of a very strange toy, but everybody had to have them. There's a great movie that was made about this. I forget the title of it, but it featured Sinbad and Arnold Schwarzenegger as two dads that were out to try to get the Christmas fad of the year.
I
think that movie encapsulates a lot of what Girard is talking about with these rivalries. And so I guess to get back to Girard a little bit, as these rivalries build, and like I said, it's usually not just, you know, one set of rivalries. You got a whole network of rivalries. It builds tension and it builds social tensions. And I think, you know, a lot of what we're seeing in the headlines, in the news, is this growth of social tensions that ultimately, when you start to peel it back, it is based a lot off of the idea of sort of a scarcity of prestige, a scarcity of goods, and a desire by multiple people to have the same set of goods, same set of things, that leads to these tensions and rivalries, etc. And so what Girard says is this builds up in a society. Eventually, it creates a point of chaos where it leads to violence. And it leads to an uncontrollable state. And so to control the violence, you have to have a separation of good violence from bad violence. And that's where Girard kind of takes a turn into religion a little bit. His second major book was called Violence and the Sacred. And I think this was really where he kind of made a name for himself. And his theory was that all of the pagan religions that revolved around sacrifice, all of these sacrifices were mechanisms to resolve this tension that had built up in society around mimetic desire. So as mimetic desire built, basically the idea of needing to sanction violence to be able to control violence started to emerge. And the way that violence controlled violence was by turning it towards one person and towards one object. And that one person that the violence was turned towards was a scapegoat. So pagan religion starts off with a scapegoating mechanism where society wants to blame one person for all of society's problems. And then eventually society commits a corporate murder. And there's sort of an original murder. And once again, religiously, he goes back to the Bible. The beginning of Genesis, you have the genesis of desire within the Garden of Eden and the Adam and Eve story. And then you have the genesis of the first murder, which took place between Cain and Abel. And with that first ordered murder, you have the beginnings of the sort of control of violence within society, the sort of the basis of the social order within the world. And so you have Cain, that simultaneously where he was the world's first murderer, but also very interestingly, when you look at the Bible, he was also the world's first founder of cities. So he was the first sort of progenitor of the social order of cities and societies that, according to Girard, is sort of a hint that it's based off of this idea of through a sanctioned act of violence, we're going to control the violence and therefore bring peace to society.
Yeah, there's this that's really a good job laying that out. I see this is this progression that you're touching upon, and I think Girard calls it this. He has this expression, a theater of envy. And in this theater of envy, you have this mimetic crisis that results from that rivalry and competition that we were talking about. And this isn't just about beanie babies now. This is now, like you said, these are societies or nations and rulers of nations, right? And then they want, you know, at one level, we want people to love what we love or like what we like, but there's a point at which that results in a kind of competition. And then that sort of competition, as you talk about, can form into systematic opposition. So with the systematic opposition, you have conflicts that become self-reinforcing. And now you can hear that I am in my remote cave because the dogs are going crazy. But so sorry about that. But these conflicts then begin to escalate. And then there has to be as you mentioned, it's touched on in the Bible. Another place, in addition to what you pointed out, Mark, is look at Leviticus chapter 16, verses 20 to 28. That specifically uses the word scapegoat, and that is where the priest transfers the sins of the people onto a goat. And then the goat, that goat is then driven out of their community. And it's a, you also, again, kind of, you can kind of see this again in Kings. But this scapegoating is a way in which these societies, according to Girard, discharges the discharges the pent up hostility and violence and hatred towards the other, and simultaneously wages, like you said, a kind of murder or a kind of war of all against the one or a small minority group. And that also results as in that release and brings about peace, because now all of this rivalry, this conflict, this opposition has been discharged in a violent act. And that violent act then becomes, needs to be repeated. And therefore, through repetition, you have what? Ritualization. There becomes rituals around this stuff. And I know, let's pause there, because I think we're up for a break. But when we come back, let's maybe pick up on this idea of the sacred and the violent.
And we'll take a look at that right after this break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
At Catholic Radio, we love to hear from you. Call us anytime. Just recently, we found this message on our voicemail.
I'm a non-Catholic that listens to your Catholic radio station, and I just wanted to thank you guys. I listen to Catholic Answers and Al Cresta sometimes, and I think her name's Teresa Tomio. I listen to her and another show or two. I appreciate it.
Call us at 317-870-8400 and let us know what you're thinking.
I just called to say, you know, I'm not a Catholic. I listen to your station.
Welcome back to The Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford in my cave. Timothy O'Donnell's in his cave. Mark Tuttle's in his cave. And we're practicing social distancing in the extreme, being able to record via the internet and connecting and all those fun programs that are out there. So, you know, our sound quality might not be what we want it to be, and occasionally we might have a dog walk in, or, you know, one of my kids might be knocking at the door. You never know. So it's one of those things, at least we can still bring you new editions of The Cave and keep Catholic Radio on the air and moving throughout the COVID crisis and everything else that's going on. We were talking about René Girard. And, you know, I believe, Mark, you were getting ready to make a point there.
Well, we were talking about how in society, as tensions build up over all the vast rivalries that we have, all our disagreements, all the social tension that's there, René Girard theorized that eventually it gets out of control. And in any society, it's going to get out of control. And in ancient man, in the beginning of civilization, the way it was brought under control was society kind of focused. And there was sort of a unanimity of everybody coming together to focus all of that tension and energy on one point. And that one point in Judaism was the scapegoat. It was an actual goat that they took all of the sins of the community and drove that goat out into the desert. And to Girard, he saw this as a common point of all of the pagan religions. Actually, religion itself revolved around this sacralization and sacralization of violence to be able to control sort of the unproductive, uncivil violence. So you had violence that was sanctioned by religion, violence that was sanctioned by the government, focused on one person to be able to unite everybody. So everybody became united. There was great unity. All of the tensions, all of the rivalries, everything fell away because it was all focused on getting rid of this one person that was seen as the generator, the one that caused all of these problems. And then once that person was gone, Well, what happened? All the tension started to build back up. Eventually the unity that everybody was feeling went away, it dissipated, and all of society's problems came back, and it started to bubble up until it was out of control again, and then the process needed to be repeated. And so primitive man saw this as almost a magical sort of way to get rid of social violence. If we magically get rid of the scapegoat or magically get rid of the person that created all this tension, then that magic takes away all of society's problems. And it wasn't a large leap in the primitive mind to move from social tension to any problem. Well, hey, if it took care of our problem of violence, maybe it'll take care of our problem of disease. Maybe it'll take care of our problem of the volcano that seems to blow every once in a while. Maybe we can use this idea of a scapegoat to get rid of all of our problems. And so after a while, this scapegoat became godlike. This was the person or entity to whom we could sacrifice to save our society and get rid of our society's problems. And so, you know, there's kind of two key ingredients there. Everybody's united in focusing on the scapegoat, and by getting rid of the scapegoat, it magically seems to get rid of all of society's problems. And according to Girard, that's the beginning point for all of religion. Whether it was Judaism or whether it was paganism, all of religion is it kind of originates with that.
Yeah, he brings up there's a systemization and ritualization. Again, he uses that term sacred violence. And it's at the god or god's command that this is then happening. It's in a way to appease them. And you see it really done magnificently in film, in Mel Gibson's film Apocalypto, where you have that film is based on the Aztec civilization that among other gods, they had a sun god that they would worship. They had built these magnificent kind of pyramid type structures, and they were going through a drought. And so they thought this massive, powerful civilization was going through a drought, and they thought the drought was because the sun god was angry with them. And to appease them, the sun god, what meant that they needed to sacrifice. So they would send out war parties out through to remote areas outside of their area of immediate control, and then capture males, adult males, and bring enslave them, bring them back, and then kill them in a ritual with their what I would call, you know, with their version of like a priest, if you would, kind of witch doctor looking kind of individuals. And then they would just continue in this blood sacrifice to the cheers of the people until it began to rain, signaling that there had been enough bloodshed, enough violence, and the people were happy because now the sun god was pleased. You need rain to have crops. You need rain for drinking water, all that kind of stuff. And so it's portrayed. And so René Girard sees that, like you said, Mark, in his as he got exposed to great epics and great myths through the literature he had been reading, and he sees this as a pattern that's repeated over and over and over again throughout these throughout pagan both pagan civilizations, societies, but also in epics and myths.
Just a point of correction, Apocalypto was actually Mayan rather than Aztec. Just for the listeners to know.
Yeah, I couldn't remember.
Mayan rather than
Aztec. Thank you, yes.
Okay.
Oh, hey, speaking of adding in some important detail, I believe the Sinbad Schwarzenegger reference movie that we're talking about before was called Jingle All the Way, 1996.
Yeah, I remembered the movie. I just could not remember the title. So thank you for that. Yep. But yeah, so Girard's theory, though, that all of these religions, including to a certain extent Judaism and therefore, you know, Christianity is an offshoot of Judaism, started that way. But he noticed very quickly there was something unique about Judaism. And that is, while these myths and stories were recreated and told from the perspective of society, and they were there to sort of obscure the original violence that their society was based upon, some sort of original murder that took place. And almost all the myths he could trace back to some sort of plausible explanation of an actual real murder that might have taken place to try to control sort of the control unrest within society. In Judaism, you began to have this myth told not from the perspective of society, but from the perspective of the victim. So starting with the Psalms and starting with the prophets, you have an unveiling and a sort of disclosure of the gig. You know, the system is being rigged here, and it's being held together by violence, and is being held together by state-sanctioned violence. And with Judaism, you start to have a revolt against that. You start to have sort of an unveiling of it and a disclosure of it, that this is all really based on a lie and a murder at the beginning. And so with Judaism, you start to have a disclosure of what this original myth actually is.
Yeah, there's all kinds of examples, you know, that we can point to where you have groups that are united in their violence, in this scapegoating mechanism. And Girard said, you know, says that this is really a universal foundation for all human cultures, for, as you mentioned, for overcoming uncontrolled violence. So we control it, we sacralize it, and that unites us against a common enemy. And you can see, I mean, one of the quintessential examples, I would say, of that phenomenon, that mimetic theory in action, would be Hitler and National Socialism, who clearly, a lot of groups they didn't like, but of course that we all know that they took a particular care to exercise viciousness and malice towards Jews, and blamed everything on them and really scapegoated them, and then which culminates, of course, in the Holocaust as an example. But you see what? You see a lot, you see a kind of, as Hitler and the Nazis rise to power, they're able to get votes, right? He doesn't come to power through a coup, the putsch. He tried that in 23, didn't work. He ascends through the established political system, now with ruthlessness and cunning, to be sure. But he is able to, I would say, successfully exercise an element of scapegoating to gain power. That to me would be one example of the 20th century. And there's more contemporary ones too. I would say a very recent past would be ISIS. ISIS took it upon themselves to scapegoat who? Christians and the Yazidis were scapegoated. And that resulted in not only mass murder, but mass enslavement and things of that sort of horrible nature as well. So it's kind of all around us. And those are very violent examples. But I would say, even a less violent example is when a group of us get together and gossip and run somebody down that's not there. is also an example of mimetic, of scapegoating, you know. And then when we do that, why do we do that? Well, there's this sort of sinful pleasure in us getting together and sharing how awful this one person is. And we feel a kind of unity as we're sharing our gossip about this one person who's being, whose reputation we're running down, unjustly. And that's a different kind of example in terms of magnitude, but the mimetic theory, as you said, I really like the term he used. It's very durable. And once you understand his mimetic theory, you kind of can't help but see it all around you.
Yeah, especially I think in politics, because, you know, politics ultimately is the art of wielding power. And that power in worldly terms comes from us exerting ourselves against somebody else. And we usually do that by getting as many people to back us and focusing that power against an adversary, whether it's a perceived adversary or whether it's a straw man that we have to make up. We're coming up against a break again. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about this worldly power. And then we'll talk a little bit about the religious sense of how this is diffused in and through Christianity particularly.
And we'll do that right after this break. You're listening to The Catholic Cave on Catholic Radio Indy.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell and Kent Blanford. And we are unpacking the thought of René Girard, Catholic history professor, literary professor, anthropologist. I'm trying to think what academic field his work doesn't really touch. And the reason we're looking at it is to try to understand a little bit about what's going on in our current climate. We were just talking about how Girard understands political power. And according to Girard, political power comes from the channeling of all of these innate rivalries, all of this desire that we have other people's things, whether it's a desire to be somebody that we're not, to gain at the expense of others. All of these tensions build up in society, and the way political power is wielded is by channeling that and directing that against a scapegoat, against somebody that we can say, aha, that person or that group of people, they are the cause of our society's woes. They are the cause of our society's problems. And ultimately, society uses that to bring about peace. You know, in the Bible, Jesus, at one point, when he's casting out some demons, he's asked the question, in whose name are you doing this? And he raises the question, how can Satan drive out Satan? And Girard takes that little phrase in some of his works, and he says, you know, this is really Jesus sort of unpacking the power within the world. How Satan drives out Satan and how the power of the world works is one set of devils basically driving out another set of devils and driving out another set of devils to continue to wield peace. And that peace only works as long as everybody's in on the game. And the original, I guess, sort of crime is hidden from view. And what Girard says is Christianity and Judaism, unique among all the rest of the religions of the world, begin to uncover this and disclose the nature of the scapegoating. And they start to tell the story of the scapegoating from the standpoint of the victim. Until ultimately you have Jesus, who Jesus is the universal cosmological scapegoat. He's the one that bears the sins of the entire world on his shoulder, that we disclose, you know, we disclose the guilt of the whole world through his sacrifice and his resurrection there on the cross. And by doing that, we have sort of undone the power of the world. We've undone the power of Satan by uncovering it. And what is Jesus's last words on the cross, or some of his last words? Forgive them, for they know not what they do. And so it's through that forgiveness in the face of our enemies, that forgiveness and that ultimate mercy that we show to those that are persecuting us, that we diffuse these mechanisms of power. And so it's ultimately by taking up our own crosses, putting ourselves in the situation of the scapegoat, or pointing out when other people are being scapegoated, and that through forgiveness and through the dislodging of this, we kind of undo the world's power and we undo the world's mechanism. And that's how Christ wields power throughout the world. So it's a really interesting sort of anthropological look at Christianity. And I think kind of the anthropological side of what Christianity does.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. With, as I've read Girard and understand him, and I think this is this point, I think, is what really led to his conversion to Catholicism. And why Catholicism isn't just one more of the great myths that he had studied or encountered. And one of the primary differences, or the central difference, is that in all of these epics and myths, the god or gods were ordering the violence for their appeasement. Where when you look at Jesus Christ on the cross, you have what? You have the opposite happen. It's 180 degrees. God isn't ordering the violence. God sides with the victim and becomes the sacrificial victim himself. That move, you know, is what, as you're pointing to, I would say is a sort of deconstruction of the great myths, that the sacrificed self-immolation undoes the sacrificial violence, because God isn't ordering it for his or her appeasement, but rather it sides with the victim and, as you point, undoes it. And that I think is what becomes a decisive moment in René Girard's spiritual journey.
Right, and it really is, when you think about it, that move of Christ putting himself in the place of the victim and God himself becoming that sacrificial victim, it's an undoing of all of these mechanisms of power that have ruled the world since time began. And so Christ's death and resurrection becomes a true turning point of history. Suddenly, the mechanisms and the way that the world wields power has been uncovered. It's been disclosed. And the rest of us can see it. But for us to be able to kind of channel that and use that going forward after Christ's death, it takes our participation. It takes our ability to forgive as Christ forgives, and to look at those who are persecuting and say, I'm not going to continue this anymore. I'm simply going to forgive. And so you have this notion of infinite forgiveness in the face of violence. That is how Christ wields power in the world and how it kind of undoes the world. The upside of that is, and Jesus warned of this, in some ways it leads to more chaos. It leads to more crisis because we've taken away the central mechanisms for controlling the violence. So by taking away the world's mechanisms, in some ways Christianity opens up the possibility for kind of a more violent, more a lot more tension as the central gospel idea of forgiveness is spreading out throughout the world. So Jesus, you know, kind of alludes to this when he says, you know, I came not to bring peace, but the sword. His death really allows the violence to kind of go out, because as society becomes more and more Christianized, the mechanisms that society and civil society have to control the violence becomes less and less.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, I would call it like a neo-religiosity. So as Christianity, Catholicism in particular, has been pushed out, marginalized, its influence waning, there's a vacuum that's being filled. And ways in which, pardon me, I think that's being filled is, for example, I would say, in the current setting, we do have in this sort of post-Christian setting a letting loose of this contagion of violence. Because how is that showing up? Well, I think it shows up in very concrete ways. I think abortion is an example of mimetic theory, where we have, as a society, we have ritualized abortion as a sacred right by some, and legalize and fund it. Religious freedom is another one, where those of us trying to exercise religious freedom are often scapegoated. And you and I have been directly involved in trying to protect our religious freedom. But there's all kinds of instances of, say, Catholic adoption agencies being closed in Illinois because of their insistence that every child deserves a mother and a father. There's a kind of new creed that's out there too, and I think that that will brook no dissent. Think about it's not in the headlines recently, but of recent memory was what so-called same-sex marriage and the agenda and ideology that's come along with that. That's not behind us. That even has morphed now into transgender ideology. And there's are very powerful, if you oppose it, there are very, very powerful forces that are unleashed to punish and quell any dissent.
Yeah, you know, Girard really lends, his theories really lend itself to sort of a re-envisioning of Augustine's two cities that he talked about, you know.
And we talked about it not that long ago.
Yeah, we did a whole show on Augustine and the city of God. And, you know, if you've got these two cities, you've kind of got these two modes of dealing with this, with man's sinfulness. On the one hand, you have the mode of trying to control violence and control man's violent nature through sanctioned violence, which continues to, I think, you know, create more scapegoats, channel the aggressions toward different groups, different people, etc. But then you have the godly city. You have the city that's following Christ's example of placing ourselves in the place of the scapegoat and allowing ourselves to ultimately become that victim that can then discharge that, not by adding more to it, not by retaliating, not by creating new scapegoats, but by saying, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And it's through that forgiveness then that it becomes discharged. And so you've got this continual, I think, battle going on of these two cities that are mixed within the world, that's going to go on until the end of time. It's going to go on until Christ comes back to sort of bring about a resolution of this. But in the meantime, it's not surprising that we see more and more tension. It seems like every time Christianity makes inroads and we come to a more Christian, more peaceful, more victim-oriented type of place, that gets channeled in new and unique sorts of ways to bring back the old rivalries, to bring back the old mechanisms, to bring back the old violence, to try to control the violence in the world's sort of way. And so this is just going to go on until the end of time.
Well, that's rather bleak, Mark.
It is rather bleak. And I think, you know, I think one of the things Girard does is sort of opens our eyes to the idea that mankind is not going to be mankind's savior. Mankind is inherently sinful in himself. And as man tries to solve our own problems, all we can expect is for man to kind of continue to create more tension and more rivalry. And I hate to say it, in the words of just about everybody's grandma, we all need Jesus. I mean, I think that's the ultimate answer to a lot of this, is y'all need Jesus. And, I think when we look at the world out there, it becomes incumbent on us. And as we see the tension in the protests that are going on, as we see the tension that's kind of created around reactions to our quarantine, unemployment has gone up, there's going to be this tendency to want to create scapegoats, to want to blame this on somebody, to want to find somebody that we can channel all of this and say, aha, he or them or those people are the reason that we're all suffering. And the fact of the matter is, the answer to this is that we have to become Christ. We have to be Jesus, and we have to remind everybody else that, no, ultimately the answer is y'all need Jesus.
And with that, we'll wrap it up for this week's Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, y'all take care out there. Stay safe, stay in, and we'll catch you next week. Be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at catholicradioindy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400. Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.